You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
If I was hard-pressed and I had a lot of time, say a year, to accomplish it, I think I could write a pamphlet. But my guest, Eve Golden, has written a virtual library of books on performers of the first half or so of the 20th century. And these books include biographies of Jean Harlow, John Gilbert, Kay Kendall, Vernon and Irene Castle, and Anna Held. Eve Golden's new book is called Jane Mansfield, The Girl Couldn't Help It. It's an in-depth look at this misunderstood film star, punctuated by Eve Golden's sly sense of humor. Eve Golden, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much for having me on.
And while we were talking, while I was introducing you, you wrote another book about Lupe Velez.
I'll have three more done by tomorrow.
You're writing a book about Lupe Velez?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I was just making some notes on it this morning. It's due at my publisher by the end of this year, and I'm pretty much done with the research and am diving headfirst into the first draft right now.
Well, I know that I'll have you back and we can talk about Lupe Velez in more depth then, but I want to just get into it a little bit with you before we talk about Jane Mansfield.
Well, I can tell you, no, she did not drown in her toilet.
Oh, well, that's good.
I was thinking of calling it Lupe Velez, No, She Did Not Drown in Her Toilet.
That's a good title to debunk her Hollywood Babylon image, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. She was a delightful actress.
So talented. I watched just about all of her films that are still available. And what stunned me was how versatile she was in drama, comedy, musicals. I mean, she had it all over Garbo, as far as I'm concerned.
Really? And she was a very beautiful woman.
Gorgeous. Sure. She was as gorgeous as Garbo. And yet she could also do comedy and was an amazing singer. So the fact that she didn't have a bigger career is infuriating. And a lot of it was because she didn't have a major studio backing her. She was more of a freelancer.
And what about race? Did that play an issue in her?
A lot. And I'm getting into that a lot in the book. And I need to find a Mexican historian and cultural person to make sure I'm not making any stupid Anglo girl mistakes in this book, like using America when Mexico is in America.
That's right. Yes, Mexico is on the continent of North America. She made a movie that I can't remember the title of, that's a hilarious comedy with Frank Morgan, who played the Wizard in The Wizard of Oz.
Oh, do you mean The Half-Naked Truth?
Yes, that's the one, The Half-Naked Truth. That movie is bizarrely hilarious.
I love that. And the high point of her career practically is that Broadway shimmy number that she does, the Mr. Carpenter song. I just can watch that over and over again.
So great. I think she could have, she was maybe ahead of her time. She would have been a great sitcom star.
Well, she was kind of, I make the point that she was kind of Lucy Ricardo with Ricky's accent.
Yeah. That's who she is. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm looking forward to reading that book. And I'm going to have to go back and read all these other books, because now that I've really enjoyed your Jane Mansfield book, The Girl Couldn't Help It, because you've written about some people that I'm really in love with and fascinated with, like Jean Harlow and John Gilbert, and people who I know very little about. Vernon and Irene Castle, I know because Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers played them in their last RKO picture. Mm-hmm. But I've never seen them
There are some clips of the actual Vernon and Irene Castle on YouTube.
And he died in World War I, isn't that right?
Yes, he died in 1918. And you can really see in those clips what really brilliant, sleek, fun dancers they were.
And what interested you in writing about them, and how did you research something that had happened and was so famous so long ago?
Well, the hardest part of any biography is finding a viable subject. It has to be somebody I like and whose work I like. It has to be somebody who hasn't had a definitive book yet. And there has to be enough documentary material on them to write a book. There's a lot of people I would love to write about, but there's not enough material on them. Mm. Thank goodness now. I started writing back in the late 80s. when you had to go to libraries and go through scrapbooks by hand. And now there are so many things on digitized newspapers and magazines that I can sit here confined in, you know, my plague apartment, not seeing people, and research a book.
Yeah, I guess it's a lot easier now.
Now, Lincoln Center was a huge help because Anna Held and Theda Bara and Irene Castle left a lot of their scrapbooks to the Lincoln Center Theater collection. Mm. So I was able to go through their own actual scrapbooks, and that was amazing.
You've written about Theda Bara as well?
Oh, yeah. Love her.
Yeah. Now, there's a very, I mean, she made a lot of films, but very few of them are still in existence, right?
A few still turn up. I was able to see all of her films that still exist. And I know that a few minutes of, not even a few minutes, but maybe a minute of Cleopatra has turned up. And it looks like it might just be a costume test, really.
Oh, wow. And what a costume.
Very little of it.
And so Theda Bara, she, you know, she wasn't really Theda Bara at all. She was a Jewish
girl. She was a nice college-educated Jewish girl from the Midwest. And she made no bones about that. The publicity people put out all these stories about her being, you know, the daughter of an artist and a dancer born in the shadow of the pyramids. And Theda never made any bones about, no, I'm just from outside, you know, Ohio.
What was her real name? Was it Theda Bara?
Theodosia Goodman.
Theodosia Goodman.
And Theda was a nickname, and Barringer was one of her mother's family names. So that's how she got her stage name.
Wow. And when you write about, I can see that your books have a kind of an interlocking overlap because they all lived in America in the 20th century and were part of the entertainment world, but they kind of fit together. Does one lead you to the next one?
Not really. I mean, certainly a brief life and a tragic death makes for a good book.
Yeah.
You know, Vernon Castle dying in World War I is more interesting than Irene Castle dying of a heart attack in her 70s.
Wow. And so when did Irene Castle die then?
She died, oh my gosh, you're going to press me today, 68 or 69, I think it was.
So well into the modern era.
Oh yeah, I kind of remember when she died because we got Time magazine. So I used to go through that, and I didn't know who Irene Castle was at the time, but I remember reading her obituary.
Yeah. Well, it's not only do you now have access to newspapers and magazines, but the films. I mean, when you and I were growing up, we had to really search to find films.
We had to sneak downstairs at 3 o'clock in the morning when the local PBS station was showing old movies and listen to it 2 inches away with the sound down so we wouldn't wake our parents up on a school night.
That's exactly what I did. Yep, I also would like scan the TV guide and it was like, oh, Duck Soup is going to be on at 10 a.m. on, I'm going to have to be sick on Wednesday.
Yeah, we all did that.
On Tuesday night, I'd say, Mom, she goes, you're going to school. Because she could tell when I was leading up to telling her that I didn't feel well. And so then I would go to school, get sick, come home, and be home in time for my 10 a.m. showing of Duck Soup.
Oh, yeah. Did you tape record films on a real
I did. I had a little Craig cassette recorder.
All us old movie geeks.
Oh, it's, this was when home video came in, it was like, wow. Because to me, collecting a movie was watching it, seeing it.
I can't believe I can sit there in the comfort of my own bedroom and watch an old movie on my phone.
Yeah.
That to me is astonishing. And I think these kids today, they have so much more access to these films than you and I did.
And yet no interest in them, sadly. Well, I don't know. I wouldn't want to watch Lawrence of Arabia on my phone, but
oh dear God, I wouldn't want to watch Lawrence of Arabia at all. That thing's like a week long. I'm kind of with John Waters, who says that no film should be over 90 minutes long.
I happen to love movies that are 88 minutes or 62 minutes. I mean, speaking of Duck Soup, I think it's 65 minutes long or something.
Well, most of Lupe Velez's Mexican Spitfire movies are about an hour long.
Yeah. Well, I mean, were the Mexican Spitfire movies considered B pictures?
Oh, definitely B, verging on C. So they were played on the bottom half of the bill, and really could not be more than an hour long, really.
Right. That was kind of,
and they shot somehow with two of them. They shot two of them at once. So poor really? Lucy was running from set to set, not knowing which film she was on.
So she really was making a sitcom with those.
Basically, yeah.
There's quite a few of them. And no, Lupe Velez didn't die when she was like, I mean, she was young, but she wasn't like 30. She was like 40 when she died?
She was 36.
Oh, uh-huh.
And her suicide is a lot more complicated than people think. It wasn't just she was married and unpregnant. There was terrible career trouble. She just lost a major Mexican film contract. Hollywood was done with her. All she could get was vaudeville, and we're talking vaudeville in 1944.
So the end of vaudeville.
Her friends and her sister and her boyfriend all basically turned their backs on her. So it was a really bad time for her.
Oh, that's terrible. But sounds like good reading.
I hope so. I'm still working on it.
Well, I still want to talk about Jane Mansfield because we're talking with Eve Golden, and she's just written a book about Jane Mansfield called The Girl Couldn't Help It. But she also wrote a book about John Garfield. I mean, I'm sorry.
Gilbert.
John Gilbert, who, so you could verify or debunk. Many people believe that his career ended because he had a terrible sounding voice. And some people believe that his career ended because Louis B. Mayer torpedoed his career, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But so what really did happen?
Kind of both of those and more. He and Louis B. Mayer hated each other. There's stories going around that Louis B. Mayer decked him in a men's room, or John Gilbert decked Louis B. Mayer in a men's room. And there's so many different versions of that story. I tend not to believe any of them. Uh-huh. He had a perfectly good voice and would have had a great career as a character actor, except he kind of torpedoed himself. He refused to take a salary cut when talkies came in. He loved annoying Louis B. Mayer, which is not a smart thing to do. And Irving Thalberg is not going to, even Irving Thalberg and he were great friends, but Irving Thalberg is not going to stand up for you when it comes to money. And John Gilbert, he was his own worst enemy, but the great thing about him is he admitted it. He said that he owned all of his own mistakes, said that there was absolutely nobody to blame but himself, which is one of the reasons I love him.
The Big Parade is one of the greatest movies ever made. It still holds up as a great, great work of art. I love that film, and he's great in it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that was his favorite film. He was a perfectionist, and he got very few films that were perfect. But I think that if you asked him what his favorite film would be, that would be it.
Yeah, it's a great one. And his is it the last picture he ever made when he came back with Garbo in Queen Christina?
I'm not that big a fan of Queen Christina. John didn't have much of a role in that. He just kind of stood around and gazed adoringly at Greta Garbo, and there's really only so much you can do with that. Uh-huh. I like his very last film for Columbia, The Captain Hates the Sea, which was a kind of a B seagoing Grand Hotel or Dinner at Eight. It was all stars or B stars and interlocking vignettes about different characters on a tramp steamer. And
I'll have to check that one out.
It's great. It's a very underrated film. And John Gilbert plays a washed up alcoholic trying to get off the bottle and, you know, kind of real life.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so your book about Jane Mansfield, that's kind of the most modern person that you've tackled as a author, because there are actually lots of people around who knew Jane Mansfield. And
yes, I'm great pals with one of her boyfriends, Nelson Sardelli, and was able to talk with people who worked with her. I spoke to the man who invented the Jane Mansfield hot water bottle, and a delightful fellow. He did not offer me one, to my disappointment.
No.
He was very nice. I spoke to her third husband, Matt Simber. So yeah, I was able to, usually I get to talk to the children of the people I'm writing about, but this time I get to talk to their friends and coworkers.
Oh, what about Mariska Hargitay? Were you able to talk to her?
The children did not want to cooperate. They were all very polite about it, but they've been burned before. They're tired of talking about her, and they didn't know if they can trust me or not. They don't know me, and I don't blame them. So, Yeah. So Jane Marie, fortunately, the eldest, had given a lot of interviews to newspapers in the past, and I was able to use those quotes. But I hope the kids like it. I kept in mind the whole time I was writing it, I didn't leave anything out or whitewash anything, but I did keep in mind, she's got kids who might read this. So, you know, be careful what you're saying.
I'm Gary Shapiro. You're listening to From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're chatting this week with Eve Golden. She's a biographer of show business personalities, and her books include Platinum Girl, The Life and Legends of Jean Harlow, Vamp, The Rise and Fall of Theda Bara, Anna Held, and The Birth of Ziegfeld's Broadway, Vernon and Irene Castle's Ragtime Revolution, John Gilbert, The Last of the Silent Film Stars, and her brand new book, Jane Mansfield, The Girl Couldn't Help It. We'll continue chatting with Eve Golden right after this. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're chatting with Eve Golden. She's a biographer of American film and stage personalities, including Jean Harlow, Theda Bara, Anna Held, Kay Kendall, Vernon and Irene Castle, John Gilbert, and her new book, Jane Mansfield, The Girl Couldn't Help It. She's working on a book about Ida Lupino.
You did a marvelous job of bringing her to life for me on the page. And
Thank you.
She's kind of a mysterious character until I read your book, that is.
Still can't figure her out.
Yeah, the thing about Jane Mansfield is that she was a real person who really lived, as not just an image that's, you know, been, or that famous photograph of her and Sophia Loren, which we'll talk about, I'm sure. That you really fleshed her out, so to speak, and gave us an idea of the kind of person she was. And I went back and rewatched some of her films, and I really enjoyed The Girl Can't Help It and Will Success Spoil Rock Hunter. Those were really, really great movies. They're a lot of fun, and Frank Tashlin is such a great director. It was great to see his work with her. And of course, I think now you wouldn't be able to make those pictures or make any of those jokes because people wouldn't find them funny, although they are hilariously funny. So tell me a little bit about how she got started in her career. Would you say that she was either ahead of her time or too late for the studio system?
Because she could have been a glamorous 1920s movie star like Gloria Swanson or Paula Negri, and she would have loved that. And a lot of the columnists who'd been around in the 20s brought that up, that she was the last gasp of the old Hollywood. But on the other hand, she would have been great today on social media and having her own reality show. So she was both ahead of and behind her time. One of the things that's so infuriating and puzzling about her is she was so intelligent and so eloquent and so well-spoken. But on the other hand, if there was a boneheaded decision to be made, she made it. She wanted what she wanted. And no matter how people tried to talk sense into her and say, no, don't take that semi-porn film in Italy and don't show up at the premiere in a leopard skin bikini, Janie did what Janie wanted to do. And she was convinced it was the right thing.
And she did a lot of stuff. I was really like, I had forgotten or I never knew that she did an Alfred Hitchcock hour. She made record albums.
A kiss on the hand may be quite continental, but diamonds are a girl's best friend. A kiss may be grand, but it won't pay the rental on your humble flat, or help you at the automat. Men grow cold as girls grow old, and we all lose our charms in the end. But square cut or pear shape, these rocks won't lose their shape. Diamonds are a girl's best friend. Romance is divine, and I'm not one to knock it, but diamonds are a girl's best friend. Romance is divine, yes, but where can you hawk it when the flame is gone? Just try and pawn a tired Don Juan. Some men buy and some men sigh that to make you their wife they intend. But buyers or sires, they're such gosh darn liars. Diamonds are a girl's best friend. Stash those rocks in your strong box, for on them you can always depend. It's not compensation, it's self-preservation. Diamonds are a girl's best. I don't mean rhinestones.
And they weren't junky record. I mean, some of her record albums were pretty bizarre, right? I mean, she did one.
Oh my God, you just look at the cover of Shakespeare, Tchaikovsky, and Me, and you realize the whole thing's a put on, but at the same time, she does it so seriously.
Right. So, I mean, she was a mysterious character.
And Jane Mansfield for president, the White House or bust.
Or bust. And that was that her idea, or she had writers, or
she had agents and she had publicity people. As a matter of fact, she was paying too many people to do the same job at the same time, and they were all arguing with each other. So it was a mess. She would sign any contract you put in front of her.
No, so she was from where? I mean, where did she hail from?
She's from my hometown, Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania. She's the only actual movie star born on the main line. But she left when she was a few days old, unfortunately for Bryn Mawr, and grew up in New Jersey for about her first 6 years, northern New Jersey, and then moved to Austin when her mother remarried when she was, I believe, six. So she really grew up in Texas in a very nice, I'd say, upper middle class environment. She was an only child. She had a good mother and a good stepfather and friends, and you know, surprisingly enough, she had a really happy, normal childhood.
And she never aspired to be an actress. She wanted to be a movie star, or is
yes,
that not?
From the very beginning, the first time she saw Shirley Temple in a movie, wanted to be a movie star. She always said that she was more interested in being a movie star than being an actress, but she really did work hard at her acting. And she was very professional. Even people who did not respect her or respect her work respected her professionalism. And directors and co-stars always said that she was the first to show up on a set. She was the last to leave. She knew her lines. She knew her business. She did not mind doing a take 50 times in the 90 degree heat if necessary. So she was a real pro.
One of the movies of hers that I had not heard of really, and I watched after reading your book or while reading your book, was this film called The Burglar. And
wasn't she good in that?
She's very good in it.
Plus there's such great, I don't know where you're from originally, but for me, seeing 1950s shots of Philadelphia and Atlantic City was just wonderful for me, because I remember the old pre-casino Atlantic City, and seeing so many of those places from my childhood that are gone now was very enjoyable for me in that film.
Yeah, she had arrived 6 or 8 years earlier in Hollywood. She would have been a great film noir.
Almost was when she went to England in 1959. She made two noir type crime films, and she was quite good in them. They were, you know, middling films, but she could have had a nice little career like, Diana Doors, or I can see her earlier. If she hadn't done Rock Hunter on Broadway, the way her career was starting out, she might have gone into more of a Shelley Winters or Joanne Woodward kind of career.
Right. I mean, so, you know, she emphasized her figure. I mean, she didn't necessarily have to. I mean, she had a great figure, but she could have just had a figure and made movies, right? I mean,
she made a deal with the devil.
She embraced it.
Yes, she knew that was what was going to get her instantly noticed and to the top, and it did, and she paid the price for it.
And what was that price?
Nobody ever took her seriously. To this day, people don't take her seriously. And I don't think being taken seriously was that important for her. She wanted people to love her. That's why she was so good on stage. She did a lot of summer stock and touring companies and nightclub acts. And she had this innate need to connect with the audience and be loved. And that's why she was so good on stage.
Because she, on stage particularly, she did Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. I mean, did people sort of thinking of her as a poor man's Marilyn Monroe?
Oh, definitely. She would hate to admit that, but that was, especially after Marilyn died, people said that, well, the whole blonde bombshell thing, it's kind of over and used up. Can't you find something else to do? But I don't know what else she could have done. She was a talented actress when given a good script and a good director, but she was rarely given those. So she's one of the few people I can't really project and say what would have happened to her if she'd have lived, because she was in such a spiral at the time she died that I just don't see a happy ending, even if she hadn't been in that car accident.
You know, Eve Golden, you make a really interesting point in the book that I hadn't considered before, that by 1960, the tastes were changing and other kinds of sex goddesses began to emerge, people who were more natural, like Jane Fonda and so on. And that for Marilyn Monroe and Jane Mansfield and Kim Novak, even though Kim Novak, you know, didn't die young, that their careers were virtually over already anyway.
That's why Mamie Van Doren is so interesting. She just kept right on going. Nothing's going to stop Mamie Van Doren.
But Mamie Van Doren never achieved that kind of level of fame that, I mean, she was never a movies. I mean, she was always a sex figure, sort of a sex symbol.
Excellent singer though, Mamie Van Doren.
Oh yeah?
Surprisingly, yeah. She was had a very good singing voice.
It made me think of John Gilbert, actually, because I was thinking that a lot of the reason that I'm thinking, and you can confirm or deny, that a lot of the stars of the silent era didn't necessarily become stars in the talking era, despite the success of people like Garbo and Joan Crawford and Laurel and Hardy. It wasn't so much about sound, but about the fact that there's always a turnover in movie stars and in tastes.
It's true. When John Gilbert was starting out in talkies, that was the era when the new Clark Gable and James Cagney types were becoming stars. And he was a whole different kind of actor. Now, the frustrating thing about John Gilbert is he was just on the verge of a career as a character actor when he died of a heart attack. Marlene Dietrich had gotten him a good supporting role as a villain in a film called Desire, a wonderful film with Marlena and Gary Cooper. And he could have become the next, you know, an Adolf Manju type, and gone on a Conrad Veidt. He could have gone on doing character roles for another 20 or 30 years, but he died, and that kind of put a crimp in his career.
Yeah, that definitely does.
Yeah. I mean, it was, death was not a good career move for him.
Which is, you can't necessarily say the same thing about Marilyn Monroe. It was a good career
move. Death was an excellent career. Valentino, Marilyn Monroe, death was a really good career move for them. Neither one of them would be nearly as famous if they lived into old age.
Okay, now, you wrote about Harlow as well. And,
she could have gone on acting. She could have gone into television like Eve Arden and Lucille Ball did.
Oh, you think so? Yeah, because she was hilariously funny. She was so funny.
Yeah, she was definitely. I think she would have had a long career ahead of her.
Did you uncover the mystery of her death? I mean, what do you think?
Yeah, it was not that mysterious, really. She got kidney disease in an era before antibiotics. And that was all there was to it. There were rumors that her mother was a Christian Scientist and refused to let her see a doctor. I contacted the Christian Science Church and they said, nope, she wasn't one of us. And I also got her cousin David to get her hospital records released. She had constant medical care for the last 6 months of her life. I have all the doctor's notes and hospital records. But in 1937, there was really nothing you could do for kidney failure.
Yeah, she was really young. I think 26, right?
Yeah, 26. And she was a very healthy girl up till then. She was a swimmer and a golfer and a tennis player. She wasn't really into drugs or alcohol. So this was just a matter of something that nowadays they could give you an antibiotic and you'd be fine. But in 1937, it was a death sentence, which is why I like modern medicine. I mean,
medicine's I think good.
It's like writing about Anna Held was so much fun because I love the Edwardian era. And I think, oh, if I could go back in time, I'd love to go back to the Edwardian era. And then I think for about 5 seconds and realize, no, I like modern medicine and air conditioning and the right to vote. So I think I'll stay where I am.
Air conditioning is good.
Air conditioning is excellent.
And penicillin, that's another good
one. Oh, yeah.
Air conditioning, penicillin, saran wrap, those are the good things.
YouTube, that's the only thing I like about this stupid century is YouTube. The rest of the century can go to hell, but give me my YouTube.
Speaking of swimmers, so Johnny Weissmuller must play a role in your new book.
He does. I've done all the research, but I'm just up, coincidentally, I'm exactly up to the point in my first draft writing where she meets Johnny Weissmuller. We're talking about Lupe Velez now, of course.
Yes, sorry, listeners. Yes. Our conversation is getting
too messy. They were an odd couple. He was not generally her type. And Lupe was challenging. Lupe was dialed up to 11 constantly. So she could be an extremely exhausting person. And a lot of men did not last long with her because a lot of men could only put up with so much Lupe Velez.
I'm Gary Shapiro. You're listening to From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're chatting this week with Eve Golden. She's a biographer of show business personalities, and her books include Platinum Girl, The Life and Legends of Jean Harlow, Vamp, The Rise and Fall of Theda Bara, Anna Held, and The Birth of Ziegfeld's Broadway, Vernon and Irene Castle's Ragtime Revolution, John Gilbert, The Last of the Silent Film Stars, and her brand new book, Jane Mansfield, The Girl Couldn't Help It. We'll continue chatting with Eve Golden right after this. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're chatting with Eve Golden. She's a biographer of American film and stage personalities, including Jean Harlow, Theda Bara, Anna Held, Kay Kendall, Vernon and Irene Castle, John Gilbert, and her new book, Jane Mansfield, The Girl Couldn't Help It.
In your Jane Mansfield book,
Jane Mansfield was also exhausting. Mickey Hargitay, I think, comes off as the hero of this book, because long can you be Mr. Jane Mansfield without going crazy?
And she wasn't particularly, particularly devoted to Mickey Hargitay, even though obviously
she
loved
him.
In
her own way. She was true to him in her fashion, as the song goes. She was devoted primarily to Jane Mansfield, and her children and her husbands and her boyfriends kind of, you know, were in her wake, so to speak. But she was never actively mean or abusive, or, you know, she would be shocked to death to if anyone said she was a bad wife or a bad mother, because she didn't intend to be.
Jane Mansfield had an affinity for animals. She had a lot of animals.
Mostly chihuahuas. And Lupe Velez has chihuahuas too. It looks like I'm veering into a chihuahua phase of my writing career.
I wonder what it is about chihuahuas. I don't dislike chihuahuas, but I find them to be nippy. You know, they'll bite you.
There was one of Jane's chihuahuas. Everyone celebrated when that chihuahua died, except for Jane. She had a little funeral for it and was crying and everything. And everybody else was going, oh my God, my nose and my fingers are finally safe.
But she also had an ocelot and monkeys and all kinds of things.
Said lots and lots. Well, Irene Castle was the one for the monkeys. I talked to her son and he told me the horrors of being the keeper of his mother's monkeys. Never, ever, ever get a monkey as a pet.
No, monkeys do not make good pets.
No, they really do not. And Irene Castle, she was the kind of animal rights person who would show up, you know, wearing a fur coat and leather gloves and talking about animal rights, which is really kind of adorable.
Isn't that funny? I think nowadays people know better and they don't have pet monkeys. I don't think people are allowed to have pet monkeys anymore.
Well, people do have pet. You read all the time about people's dangerous animals escaping and, you know, eating a neighbor.
Yes, that's a bad thing.
Yeah.
I guess it depends on your neighbor. Hey, we said the same joke at the same time. and she had five children. That's also kind of astounding.
We're back to Jane again.
Sorry, yes, Jane Mansfield, five children.
She definitely did not believe in birth control or abortion, and she loved her children. This was difficult to write about because she genuinely loved her children and thought of herself as a good mother, but her idea of being a good mother was having her children with her 24/7, whether it was good for them or not. I mean, she had three kids in the back seat of her car when she had the accident in the middle of night in New Orleans. They should have been with her father.
Mariska Hargitay was actually one of the people in the car when her mother died.
Yeah. She still has a scar on her face from the accident. It was very, they say that, the three kids were in the back seat. They weren't injured. They were injured. Mickey Jr. had a broken arm and a broken leg, and Mariska was almost suffocated under the wreckage and had a very serious facial injury. So they were definitely injured in that wreck. Poor Jane Marie had a very trying childhood because Jane had her when she was 16, and Jane Marie was basically a sister and then a babysitter for much of her life.
Wow. Well, one of the things that Jane Mansfield is most famous for, sadly, is something that you have demonstrated to be completely untrue, which is that she was decapitated at the time of her death. And I don't know
it's a matter of a few inches, really. I have these very graphic photographs from the accident scene that show her face, and basically, her head was sheared off just above the eyebrows. And the good thing about that is she died instantly. She did see what was coming because she had fractured, the forearms were fractured, which means that she did put her hands up to protect herself at the last second. But the three people on the front seat all died instantly. So, I mean, if there's a good side to this, it's that. But what happened was that her wig caught in the windshield when the driver of the truck that they plowed into pulled her out of the wreckage. The wig stayed in the windshield, and all the photographs everybody saw, the blonde hair on the windshield, and made the natural conclusion.
I don't know what it says about us that, you know, some of them
we're horrible, horrible people.
Yes, we're horrible.
I love this grisly stuff as much as anybody else does.
Yeah. And you write about it well, but
thank you. I like killing my people well. I give them a good send off, I think.
But yet, you know, also you're telling the truth about it. So like some of the people, like you mentioned Lupe Velez, you know, and her death was so famously written about by Kenneth Anger in Hollywood Babylon. And it's so completely wrong. It's just an untrue story. And the fact that everybody always says Jane Mansfield was decapitated when in fact, you know, she wasn't. Although, yes, those 6 inches do make a difference, don't they?
As the actress said to the priest.
Oh my God. So yes, we're obsessed with that, I guess.
Well, you know, people love that stuff, and so do I. I'm not above the grisly details and scandal and that sort of stuff. That's why I write about movie stars and stage stars. You don't find me writing about Winston Churchill, for goodness sakes.
Well, I don't know anything about Anna Held except that Billy Burke played her in the movie.
Louise
Reiner. Louise Reiner played her in the movie.
Anna Held was the biggest star in America, basically.
Wait, I have to correct myself now. So it was Myrna Loy who played Billy Burke, and it was Louise Reiner who played
Anna Held, and William Powell was Ziegfeld. And it was a ridiculous movie with very little truth in it whatsoever. Okay. It's really annoying because it betrayed Anna Held as this kind of dumb, shrinking violet type. And Anna Held was tough as nails and smart. Hmm. She was the one who invented the Ziegfeld Follies. And the reason she divorced Ziegfeld was not so much that he was cheating on her, although he was, but he was spending all of her money. She was a very smart Jewish Polish housewife, and she saved her money and she was very smart with it. But back then, the wife's money was the husband's money, and he was gambling it all away. And that's what really broke up their marriage.
She's not the shy little bird who.
Oh, hell no. As a matter of fact, you know, the scene in The Great Ziegfeld where, oh, hello, Flo, I hope you would be so happy, and with the tears running down her face. In real life, a reporter asked Anna Held if she would take Flo Ziegfeld back, and she said, who wants to smoke a cigar twice?
what a great line. I remember in the news shortly before Jane Mansfield's death that there was an incident in which one of her children had been mauled by a tiger. But now I've read in your book, and it wasn't a tiger, it was a lion. And what happened?
Well, she took the kids to a petting zoo, basically, for a publicity stunt. They'd be photographed with all the wild animals, which is a very, very dumb thing to do. And Zoltan got too close to a chained animal, which attacked him, as animals do, because they're animals.
Yes.
So he was very lucky to survive. He was very, very critically injured and almost didn't make it. And that really did shake Jane, because as there's this line in The Girl Can't Help It where she leans over, you know, with the boobs showing them to Tom Ewell and goes, people don't seem to think I'm equipped for motherhood. And it's, it's a good dirty double entendre joke, but she kind of wasn't equipped for motherhood. She didn't have what it takes to be strict, and sometimes her common sense had to be wondered about.
Well, I guess that leads us to this wonderful picture that everybody knows.
Yes.
It was a big party for Sophia Loren, which
at Romanoff's, introducing her to the American film industry. And Sophia Loren
had a figure.
The photograph that I love the most is the one of Rita Moreno reacting. because there's everybody has seen all the photographs of Jane falling out of her dress and Sophia Loren kind of goggle-eyed at her, and Clifton Webb on the other side looking at his food very carefully with an "I'm not here, I'm not here, I'm not here" look on his face. But I found a wonderful series of photographs of Rita Moreno at the same party with her eyes bugging out of her head in absolutely horrified delight at what was going on. And I said, okay, I have got to use these photographs. This is just too wonderful. That and the photograph of Queen Elizabeth II pulling a Sophia Loren and totally eyeing Jane's boobs.
the queen makes no secret of just gazing down.
Oh my God, the queen is just like absolutely, she's got the crown jewels on her head, but she's absolutely hypnotized by Jane's cleavage.
So did Jane Mansfield know exactly what she was doing when she popped her nip slip at the Sophia Loren party?
Oh gosh, yeah. Oh yeah, she was even bragging about it to one reporter, saying, stand back and watch this, basically. Well, and that's really one of the reasons why 20th Century Fox kind of gave up on her, which is a shame, because she did three wonderful films for Fox, and by 1958 they were loaning her out for crap. And then they cut her loose in 1962 when the studio was basically going broke. And I'm still annoyed all these years later that Jane did not get the Susie Parker role in The Best of Everything, which is one of my favorite films. And Jane would have been perfect in that role. Whereas Susie Parker, bless her heart, I love Susie Parker, but she could not walk across a room convincingly. And
she recites her lines as though she's learned them phonetically from...
Oh dear, bless her heart, I love Susie Parker, but Jane would have been wonderful in that role, and Fox was not interested enough in her. As a matter of fact, George Cukor, she was originally cast in Something's Gotta Give, which was Marilyn Monroe's last film, uncompleted. She was originally cast in the Glynis Johns role in the Chapman Report, and George Cukor just turned up his nose and said, I'm not working with that Jane Mansfield person, and she was bumped from the films.
There was just a prejudice against her because of the bad decisions that she'd made that you...
And nobody took her seriously. And we all know what happened on Something's Gotta Give with Marilyn. And I think George Cukor, by the end of that shoot, was wishing he'd have stuck with Jane, because at least she would have shown up on time and known her lines.
It's a fascinating book, Eve Golden. And
Thank you.
As I was saying, you really bring her to life. And it's a major book.
I hope people like her. I hope people come away from the book liking her. She's hard. You can't dislike her.
I liked her, and I really liked you. And I liked your interjections of humor in the book, which are hilarious.
I've been a professional wise ass for most of my life. So some people complain that I'm trying, there's a little too much wisecracking in my book.
It's used very sparingly.
It's the only way. Oh, and listen, 90% of the jokes are taken out in the first draft. I put some things in there that I would love to use, and I think, no, you can't get away with that, and I take it out. So you're reading the toned down version.
Well, now I want to read the first draft. But the rest of you should read Jane Mansfield, The Girl Couldn't Help It by Eve Golden. Eve Golden, your wealth of knowledge, and it's really a pleasure to speak with you, and I hope you will come back and talk to me again.
I would love to. Thank you so much.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.